Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. With me is CAI News Director Steve Junker as we continue our coverage of the 2020 election. Morning, Steve.
Good morning, Mindy.
We had a number of contested races on the Cape and Islands, and we'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts? What are your hopes and fears as the 2020 election draws to a close? Do you see opportunities to come together as a nation? And what would you like to see going forward? 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. An interesting evening for sure. The big upset, Kip Diggs ousting Will Crocker in the 2nd Barnstable District.
That was a big one. That was, and there's plenty to talk about there. I think one of the things that really caught my eye, too, was the voter turnout across the region. It was just amazing to see the numbers. Brewster, I think, came in 87%, Truro, 87% turnout, West Tisbury around 86%. You just don't see numbers like that. That's suggests the energy around this election and just how people were really invested in getting out and voting.
For sure. We'll go through some of the winners here. First Barnstable, State Representative Tim Whalen hangs on to his seat. He was challenged by Josh Mason. 5th Barnstable, Stephen Ixaros beats Jim Dever. State Senate for the Plymouth and Barnstable District, Sue Moran holds on to her seat, challenged by Jay McMahon. And County Commissioners Sheila Lyons and Mark Forrest with the most votes there, ousting Ron Beatty. 9th Congressional District, Bill Keating hangs on to his seat. And then the U.S. Senate, Ed Markey also hanging on to his. The ballot questions, right to repair, passed with a pretty good margin, 75% said voted yes. And the ranked choice, that was kind of up and down all evening, but in the end, that was defeated.
It looks like that's going to be defeated, right? Yes, about 54 to 45% on the ranked choice voting, with 54% voting no, so that does not go forward.
Yeah. Let's bring in Veronica Martinez. She's the executive director of the Mass Democratic Party. Good morning, Veronica.
Good morning, Mindy. Thank you so much for having me today.
You bet. Veronica, this was such an odd election season. So tell us a little bit about some of the things that made it different in terms of campaigning, organizing, and reaching voters.
Yeah. Odd is maybe an understatement. We took our campaigning virtually starting pretty early in March with some of our party processes. It meant, and I'm sure people experience this, a lot less door knocking and much more phone calling. But I think what was also something good about this cycle was that we really focused on relational organizing. And what that means is making sure we're turning out friends and family, building relationships locally, and explaining why it's so important for people to vote and making sure they have the information. And I think in places like the Cape, that's where you see some of these gains, where you see a win like Kip Diggs there, because of that work that's been being done in the Cape, and I hope continues past this election. I think that's something we really need to take from this cycle as we move forward.
So Massachusetts, of course, tends to vote blue, but the Cape and Islands, we've got a lot of red voters here as well. So do you expect that will continue going forward? I guess we should mention the independents, actually, the numbers are far bigger than both the Democratic and Republican registered voters, right?
Massachusetts is a very independent state, I think, in all things that we do. Certainly, independent voters make up the largest subset of our voting population. And you're exactly right. The Cape and Islands has always been a kind of purple region here, and that's why we've been investing in a long time with partner organizations like the Cape and Islands Democratic Council, doing that work I was sort of talking about building personal relationships, showing why Democratic policies matter and why they matter to places like the Cape and Islands, focusing on things like environmental issues, full-year economies, and making sure that we're supporting our elderly residents as well as our youth as well. And by having those conversations, it's not just about one election cycle. It's about building for the future, too. And so I think that we're going to see a steady trend towards a more democratic Cape and Islands as the years continue.
We talk about building a future. I'm wondering about, recruiting and helping candidates. I sometimes think, why would you want to run for office, right? You get under this microscope, it's tough. I mean, it really is tough to run for office. You got to raise money, and there's a lot to it than just putting your name out there. So, what is the Democratic Party doing to try to get more people of color, women? What's the plan there?
Yeah, so we have a recruitment program. We call it the Democratic Campaign Institute, where we teach folks the nuts and bolts of campaigning. So we run through everything, like how to fundraise, how to set up a field operation, these aren't sort of like state secrets, right? They're in industry kind of knowledge. Like I know how to build a field program because I've been doing this for 10, 15 years, but that doesn't mean that I need to keep that knowledge. And so we have the Democratic Campaign Institute. In even years, we do it as a big kind of summit. And then in odd years, we go about regionally and host them. We've hosted them on the Cape and Islands before to help recruit candidates. And from that, we've met a number of candidates who we've then helped run for office as well. And I think when you see candidates like Kip, too, when you have a great candidate who has a message that resonates locally, it's our job to help fill in the gaps. And so this year, we had our traditional coordinated campaign with field organizers, but we also hired for specific roles called election coordinators. And these election coordinators didn't just make calls and recruit volunteers like we would in a traditional field program. They worked as liaisons to the campaigns and filled in the gaps wherever they might need it, whether it's helping set up their phone banks, developing scripts, helping develop their social media content. That way we can kind of craft our support to each candidate rather than just offering a cookie cutter solution to them.
Yeah. Steve, I can't see you. You're in the studio. You have any questions you want to ask Veronica?
Hi, Veronica. I'm curious about that, the Kip Diggs race, which voters around here, you know, were participating in and really appeared like not many people saw that coming until it was coming. When did you guys kind of identify that as a district that you could flip?
So it's funny actually mentioning our election coordinator, too. So there was a primary in that district, and we don't get involved in the primary races. We support the Democrat that Democrats elect. So we had met with Kip before the primary. You know, I wasn't super familiar with him. And then after he won the primary, our election coordinator began working very closely with his campaign. And she came back and she said, he is going to be an amazing representative. She is like, he just has so much energy when he connects with people. God, I wish we could go out on the door so people could meet him. And just by telling how fired up she was, because she's been working with campaigns across the state, and she was like, this is one that we really need to win, and we can win it. And hearing that feedback, you know, we really had to go all in supporting Kip. And I think that's what did it for him, is that he is just a really dynamic candidate who understands the district and is clearly going to fight for it. And so I'm glad that even though this was a kind of odd election year, that we were able to help get that message out there and that voters saw that. And I know they're going to be really happy with him as their representative as well.
Veronica, we have a Republican governor and a Democratic majority in the state legislature. Has the Commonwealth avoided that deep partisanship and rancor that's plagued other parts of the country? Or do you see a growing divide along party lines, even in Massachusetts?
I think that divide, I think you're right. So we talked a little bit about how Massachusetts is a pretty independent state before, and I think that our elected officials work together for the best thing for the Commonwealth. And I think when we hear some of the stories of those deep, deep divides in localities, they can somewhat be sensationalized, because I think by and large, our elected officials know their communities, they're working for them, and they just want to do what's best for them as well. And so, you know, our goal is to make sure that we're moving democracy forward, that we're creating policies that are serving our communities. And I think we've been able to do that, are going to keep doing that. And so I hope that we see this same kind of coming together as communities. But I do think that that's going to be important work for us to be doing moving forward as a party. In terms of our policies, I think we have a big tent. We have diverse views on our priorities, and we're going to have to continue doing the work to bringing that together. And then especially depending on whatever happens with the presidential race, making sure that we're bringing our communities together and remembering that we all go to school together, we go to work together, we're just trying to create better lives for one another.
Yeah. Veronica Martinez is Executive Director of the Mass Democratic Party. Veronica, thanks for taking time to be with us this morning. Appreciate that.
Thanks so much, Mindy and Steve. Appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll bring in Representative Randy Hunt, representing the 5th Barnstable District, who did not seek re-election. His term ends in January. Hi, Randy.
Hey, Mindy and Steve. How are you guys?
Good. All right. So did you stay up last night and watch all the results coming in, or did you go to bed early?
How late did you stay up? That's the question.
Yeah, I stayed up so late that I know who won president.
Can you tell us? Yeah.
Yeah, that's a secret, I guess. Interesting. Yeah.
So, Randy, your thoughts on local races? I think pretty much everything went as we thought it would, with the exception of that second Barnstable district with Kip Diggs ousting Will Crocker.
Well, I thought that was going to be a tough race. It's an area that was in Democratic hands for probably around 18 years. I think Demetrius Atsilas held it for 14 years, and Brian Mantle, I believe, two terms after that. So when Will Crocker won that in 2016 in a presidential year, which is never favorable in Massachusetts for the Republicans, it was the only race, the only pickup of a seat that we had in 2016. So it was kind of remarkable that he did that, and he defended it well in 2018. But I think the so-called blue wave and to some extent the angst about the commander-in-chief that kind of runs through the down-ballot races did show through, and Will Crocker ended up somewhere around 1,800 votes short.
Yeah. You know, as obviously, as we mentioned, Stephen Ixaros, who you supported winning your seat, he'll be the next representative for the 5th Barnstable District. But, you know, this was an interesting race because Jim Dever, Stephen Ixaros, both good candidates. And I think you had said to the Cape Cod Times, you're backing Steve, but either one would probably do a good job. One of the things I thought was really commendable in that race was these two guys, they were friendly right from the start. They talked to each other. I think Steve said last night they had a bet, you know, whoever wins takes, you know, takes the other one. The loser has to buy dinner or something. There was no mudslinging. Same thing happened with in the first Barnstable with Tim Whalen and Josh Mason. I've often said this. I wish we could have trickle up instead of trickle down. We don't see a lot of campaigns that are run that way.
We don't, and that's too bad. There were a couple of shots taken during that campaign, actually more of them in the primary when Steve Ixaros was running against Tom Keyes. But it was, other than something coming out of the Mass GOP, and I'm not representing the Mass GOP, unlike Veronica, who is representing that state party. I'm just here for myself. I thought that the candidates handled themselves extremely well. It is the kind of race that I would like to see. All positive from both sides there. And like I said to the reporter in the Cape Cod Times, either one of them, and I felt this from the beginning, would have been a good representative of the 5th Barnstable District. Glad to be supporting the guy who won. But I certainly wouldn't have thought that there was any problem had it gone the other way.
Yeah. Republican Party, the minority, to say the least, here in Massachusetts. What advice are you giving Steve as he heads up to Boston in getting things done?
Well, I talked to him this morning and suggested that he get in his truck and go pick up all of his signs. And so that's number one. And he laughed because he says, I'm already out there doing that. I always thought that was a nice thing to do the next day just to clear your mind and relax a little bit. But, yeah, it's what's interesting about being in the minority party, one is your constituency is your only allegiance, period, because you're not there to try to become a committee chair, to work your way up into the Democratic ranks. So you don't have to balance any votes with, well, I want to do this, but I better check with the speaker to make sure that that doesn't screw up my career there in Boston. So I always felt like it kind of was freeing in a way. And you really have to do things based on your own set of experience. And, you know, I'm a CPA, so there were only two out of the 200 of us who were CPAs. So it's a little bit rare up there. But I was able to parlay that into working on lots of different issues, not the least of which was the opiate issue, which still is a problem, but we are far ahead of where we were when I first came in 10 years ago.
So what do you see as the biggest challenge for our region going forward?
Well, the biggest immediate challenge is getting the 2021 budget in place, which we're going to be doing this month. I don't know if that'll spill into December or not, but we'll be working on that. So we'll have a budget in place just in time for the governor to release his fiscal year 2022 budget, which would end on June 30th, 2022. And that is going to be an interesting issue of how you deal with trying to support all those needs that we have on what promises to be a shortfall in revenues. So that's something everybody up there is, you know, needing to work on. Plus, I think that we're probably going to go through a series of changes to how we deal with our first responders, and particularly our police and state troopers. And the that is certainly something that Steve Exaros has experience in. And then on top of that, there's, depending on who wins the presidential campaign, there will likely be, well, if Biden wins, there'll likely be a lot of different changes and different dynamics for how the state is supported by the federal administration. All that has to be kind of weighed into what we're doing. So I see no shortage of items coming up that Steve will have to get familiar with and take on.
Hey, Randy, how about you? You're retiring now from the seat. What are you diving into next?
Well, that's a good question. I think, I'm sorry, I think I accidentally said something that resembled Hey Siri, so that was the beep there. Well, what's happening is I am retiring from the seat. That's the first Wednesday in January. I have notified my clients that I'm not going to be doing my CPA practice next year. So I'm kind of on my road to the in-between full retirement and where I'm going to be the next few years until I get to that age. And so I don't really know yet, but I'm sure I'm going to find something fun to do. And as soon as I know what it is, I'll let everybody know too.
State Representative Randy Hunt. Randy, thanks so much for taking time to be with us this morning. Appreciate that.
Yeah, my pleasure. I appreciate it.
It's election coverage on CAA coming up. Historic voter turnout. We'll talk about voting by mail, voting early, and casting ballots on Election Day. Listeners, what was your experience like voting this time around? Share your story. 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll have more after break. You're listening to CAI's election coverage on The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. With me is CAI's news director, Steve Junker. The pandemic caused many people to consider alternatives to voting in person on Election Day, something we couldn't have imagined even a year ago. What was your experience voting this time around? Did you vote in person, by mail, or did you hand deliver your ballot to the drop-off location? Share your story, or if you're thinking about the future and what you're hoping to see, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Joining us is Ann Quirk. She's a town clerk for Barnstable. Hi, Ann.
Good morning.
Late night.
Yes.
So, Ann, when did you start counting ballots, including the mail-in and absentees, and what time did you finish?
Counting ballots this time around was an enormous effort for all town clerks because the amount that we sent out and it was just incredible. If I could, we sent out over 14,000 mail-in ballots. Many, many, many of the people that received them actually went and voted early in person. So it's really hard to define now that the election is over. Did they vote? Did they not vote? Well, yes, they voted, but which way did they vote? That's going to be a little harder to figure out because they voted early, but they voted early in person versus sending them back.
Yeah.
It was an incredible effort. The Secretary of State's office did allow us to do what they called advance opening and depositing of the ballots through the tabulators, which allowed us to start just before the election, to actually slit open those envelopes, flatten out the ballots, and put them through the tabulators for each of the precincts without actually knowing what the tabulation was until after 8 o'clock last night.
So how was the turnout in Barnstable, and how does that compare to previous presidential elections?
Well, traditionally, our turnout has been 77% of the voters, traditionally. I mean, if I go back 4 years ago and 4 years before that and 4 years before that, it's 77%. This year, it was 82.63.
Hmm. Wow. Hmm. Mm. Oh, nice high turnout.
And I'm wondering if you think that this is a precedent for us in how we voted this time around, and if so, you know, if you were going to have to do this kind of election again in 2 years, 4 years, how would you be changing how you did it, or how would you like to see it done?
Well, in order to get the ballots out to everyone, it took a crew of an amazing crew of people to help us do this. We have an office of four people. We could never have done this work without this crew of 20 to 30 extra people that came in intervals. They switched in and out so that we could be socially distant. We all had masks. We had the windows open. You know, we did everything we could to keep everybody safe. I think that's so hard because you can't really communicate that well when you're wearing a mask. And that was very, very difficult to do. But this group of people, they were amazing. They were just amazing. Most of them were poll workers. Some of them were volunteers. I couldn't have done it without them.
Yeah. So what aspects of the mail-in and early election day voting went more smoothly than expected, or were there challenges?
I think there were challenges all around, honestly, because of COVID. We limited the amount of people who could be in a precinct at any one time to protect the voters and the workers. So there were lines that may not have been lines had we had more voting booths. But I know the first thing in the morning, several of the places did have lines before 7 o'clock.
Yeah.
So, you know, that was the tough part, I think.
Yeah. What's their confusion in with people arriving to cast or mail-in ballots? And, you know, tracking that, like you get your ballot in the mail, and you mentioned some people said, well, you know what, I'm just going to do early voting instead. I think people were worried that somebody could fill that mail-in ballot and then go vote in person. But that can't happen, right?
No, you can only vote once. So once you're crossed off the voter list, you're crossed off the voter list, because we have to then put it into the voter registration information system, which is the system that builds our census, it builds our voter list. It's all kept in that computer. So once it's in there, it's in there. You can't take it back out again.
Yeah.
And what do you do now? It's like the day after all of this.
Oh, well, honestly, I have over 200 UO CAVAs to count.
What are they?
They're called UO CAVAs, United States citizens that are overseas, whether they're in the military or they're working overseas. That's what they are, and we have to hand count all of those ballots. We are getting ballots in the mail today. So through the post office, we had post offices delivered to our building last night. Up until 6:30 last night, they were bringing ballots over. So we still have this 3-day window until the 6th to get these ballots in that were vote by mail.
And you don't know how many you're expecting there then, right?
I mean, no.
Yeah. So could that change some of the outcomes of the election? I guess if it's really tight, it could. But for some of these that aren't so tight, probably wouldn't make a difference.
Right. Yeah, you're absolutely right. I don't know that it'll change anything other than, you know, it might boost somebody a little bit more. But for the numbers, when you look at it as the state of Massachusetts, no.
And then when does it get officially certified, Ann?
I have to have that postmarked by the 18th to the Secretary of State's office. So I still have, and we could have an audit because the 2016 law that added early voting also added an audit by draw throughout Massachusetts. And in 2016, we did have a precinct that was drawn, so that's on the horizon, too. So we're not really sure yet. This is not over for me, not for a long shot.
I'm wondering, and you know, the volunteers at the polls are obviously critical. And I imagine you know, there were some folks who maybe didn't volunteer this time around who you usually have, you know, for fears of COVID. Mm-hmm. What is the job of the volunteer? I'm sure there are folks who are thinking, you know, that might be an interesting thing to do. And obviously the volunteers are really, really important to getting the job done.
They certainly are. Actually, we pay everyone in the town.
Oh, you do?
But we pay all of our poll workers. Yes, we do. Every one of them gets paid. We have them. They have to go through all the paperwork and check in with HR, and then we pay them. Mm-hmm. So it's a long day for those folks too. I mean, it's been a long several days for us, but it's a long day for the folks at the polling locations. They're there at 5:30 in the morning, and they're not at home until probably 10 or 11 o'clock at night.
Mm. Yeah. And did you have long lines yesterday?
We had some. Actually, certain precincts more than others. Precinct 7 had a line all day long. I think Precinct 5 did. There were certain precincts that, yes, they did, and others that just flowed.
Do you have a sense of what the percentages were for people who voted in person versus early voting and mail-in voting?
I'll know that a little bit better once I am able to take all the tabulation and put it into different spreadsheets that I'm building here to do that, but I won't have that for a while.
Yeah. Steve, do we know about voter turnout and wait times across the Cape and Islands? I mean, you mentioned a couple of towns earlier.
Well, we know that voter turnout was very strong across the Cape and Islands. We were citing some of those numbers in the 80 percentile across, you know, places like Orleans and Brewster, and Truro was up to 87%. So we definitely know that the turnout was there for this election. I don't know about voter wait times right now.
Yeah. I guess it depends what time you go. Some of the morning lines might have been longer than the midday.
And that's traditional for voting. You know, if you go early in the morning, there's more people there, and then midday kind of gets quiet sometimes.
All right, and I heard a rumor that Kitiwit was like 99% voter turnout. Is that true?
Well, let me see if I can find their little. I have all their stuff right here. Let me just see.
And you asked the right person, Mindy. This is.
I know, right? That would be amazing, right? I mean, I don't know if we've ever seen a turnout like that at any time. I mean, that's amazing if that's true.
Let's see. Looking to see if I have these tabulations.
Is Kitiwit generally a high turnout, though?
Yes, always. That's my precinct 7. Kitiwit is always a high turnout. I have the tabulations here for the early voting in Kitiwit was 1,412 people, which is almost... Not quite, but almost, I think about a third of the voters in that town, section of town, in that village. So they always have a large turnout. As a matter of fact, they were the ones that had the line all day long.
Wow. All right, so it could be. We could be
could
there.
Could be.
All right, Ann Quirk, town clerk for Barnstable. Ann, thanks for being with us. And hopefully somewhere in the next couple of days you'll get to get some sleep.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thanks. We have an email from Joe. Joe says, I enjoyed, sort of, watching the election coverage on PBS last night. Went to bed like the rest of America, not knowing what Wednesday morning would bring. I was surprised to turn on the TV, something I rarely do in the morning, and PBS is showing cartoons. Presidential election not more important than cartoons? I don't know, Joe. That's a good question to ask. Election coverage on CAI, we'd love to hear from you. Share your experience or, you know, what you would like to see the winner of the presidential election do to bring the nation together. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll have more after a quick break. And you're listening to The Point. It is election coverage 2020. I'm Mindy Todd along with Steve Junker, our news director. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. And we have an email from Henry and Jane. Poll workers may refuse their paycheck and volunteer their services for free. At least that's the way it was in Eastham a few years back. Henry and Jane, thanks for that note. I don't know. I feel like maybe, Steve, they should be paid. It's a long day.
As Ann was saying, a long day. And a long day for lots of people yesterday. Working to make this whole process come together.
Exactly.
Yeah.
All right, we have Reverend Nell Fields, minister at the Wacoit Congregational Church, joining us. Hi, Nell.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Now, last week on the show, we discussed the Malice Against None pledge that's created by the nonprofit Braver Angels. And the pledge is a commitment not to hold hate against fellow citizens, no matter who wins or loses the 2020 presidential election. Braver Angels was founded after the 2016 election to help depolarize Americans and foster constructive conversation and civic engagement. Just want people to hear the pledge. The pledge is, regardless of how the election turns out, I will not hold hate, disdain, or ridicule for those who voted differently from me. Whether I am pleased or upset about the outcome, I will seek to understand the concerns and aspirations of those who voted differently and will look for opportunities to work with people with whom I disagree. That was a great conversation, Nell. I know you called in on that. So let's talk about what's at stake if we don't come together as Americans after this election.
Oh, gosh. From where I stand and in my perspective, I think that most people get that we need to come together. And I think it's going to take a little bit more than just a conversation. We really need leadership on all levels, you know, start in our own community, people who can bring us together, working together for a common cause. And we need leadership on the national level, somebody who will say, hey, we can't go off on our different ways. Now, when I was at the polls yesterday at the we're polling place at the Wacoit Church, and I was so proud of everybody. You know, we're standing 6 feet apart. It was a 45-minute wait at 7:19 in the morning. And I looked at people and said, wow, I know some of us are going to be voting differently from the other, but we're talking, we're chatting. There was a really good feeling of community. And I think that we just need to tap into that.
Yeah. So, and in your congregation, I'm sure you have people who don't obviously agree on, you know, how they're voting. And how do you talk about that in your sermons? Do you, have messages that you try to get out to your congregation?
Absolutely. We've been talking about this for the past 4 years. And it's not just our political differences. We have cultural differences. Some people might be for same gender marriages. Some people aren't. So, you know, there's always differences. What we hold in common, and this is one of the things that we emphasize in our community, is we all believe in a God of love. Mm-hmm. And that is our focus, that no matter what differences we have, God is still in charge. God still loves us exactly the way we are. And we're going to get through this.
And also what? Some of our shared values, right?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Because at the end of the day, we all want to be happy. We all want to live freely. We all want to... we all want a clean environment, believe it or not. You know, we do have those core values that are shared. It's just the matter of how do we get to those.
So no matter who wins the presidential election, there's going to be a lot of unhappy people, right? So what are opportunities for us to come together and show our unity as Americans?
Well, one, I believe that everything starts on the local level. One of the things that we've done over the past 4 years that has really helped us is that we've increased our outreach. We've increased our mission work. So we have a food program right now. And when you are working side by side with people, you find that you have a lot in common. So as we go forward into the next 4 years, we are going to really up our outreach to the community because it gives us meaning and it helps us to meet people where they're at.
Now, I was wondering about when the call for the spiritual and the political sort of came together in this. When did this become such a mission to bring people together across the political divide within a congregation, say?
I'll tell you, if the faith communities did not do that, it just wouldn't be done. So I really saw a shift in the last election that people were hurting. People were hurting, and some people were behaving badly. And it's up to clergy, I believe, to step in and say, okay, we have more in common than not. You know, when we are gathering, our focus is on worship. Our focus is on a God who's accepting of all people. I believe faith communities are one of the last institutions that are able to do that.
Yeah. Now, I know faith leaders of different faiths meet, and you all talk, and we have what an interfaith service this morning, right?
It's going to be at noon, and we have clergy from various faith traditions here on the Upper Cape, and we're going to they're going to lead us in prayer of hope and unity and peace. So we have about 8 or 9 faith traditions represented.
And what are the conversations that you're having with other faith leaders?
It ranges from anxiety, the anxiety level in our congregations. Also, you know, we're still really kind of focused on helping people get through this pandemic. So there's a lot of loss. And also there's some loss associated with how the election results are turning out. You know, that if your candidate doesn't win, or if you perceive a candidate doesn't espouse the same values you do, there's some loss in there. So those are the immediate things that we're navigating and that we talk about.
Go ahead, Steve.
Are there some practical advice that you give people in terms of how they can engage with these feelings of loss and anxiety that you're talking about? Things that they can almost like physically throw themselves into to try to cope with this?
Oh, absolutely. Breathe. The most important thing to do is to breathe. And when I say breathe, to take time out and to feel yourself breathe. The other thing we do is we pray. I have a group at our church. We've been praying every single day practically since COVID began. So we have a small prayer group, and we support each other. Self-care is very important during times like this, because if you don't take care of yourself, you might make some decisions that you'll regret later. So that's, you know, eating the right things, breathing, and to realize in the scheme of things, this is just a short period. I'm not saying it's not going to be bad for people and you're not going to experience loss, but look at the totality of your life. This is just a small little blip, and I believe that things are going to get better. In the long run, things are going to get better, and we have to hold on to that hope and move our feet. We've got to make it come about. You know, it's one thing to pray and it's one thing to breathe, but I also tell people, get to work. If you don't like the way things are, don't complain. Get to work. Be part of the solution.
We should mention all faiths are welcome at the noon interfaith prayer for unity, and please wear a mask, right?
Absolutely. That's, you know, that's part of the self-care there, and that's part of the love that we have for each other, is that we wear a mask to protect ourselves and others.
All right. Reverend Nell Fields, minister at the Waquite Congregational Church. Nell, thanks for taking time to be with us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Okay, bye.
Thanks. Steve, yesterday, John Dixon, the history and civics teacher at Monomoy Regional High School, put out his press release on the exit polling that the eighth graders did. And it's pretty impressive. They did this by phone. And just some of the, I'll point out some of the key, there's a lot of stuff.
A lot of stuff.
But on the issues, the top one, surprising, was the economy, cited by 33%, followed by candidate character, 21%, mm-hmm. and the pandemic and healthcare at 19%. That was a little bit surprising. Johnson, this may reflect the relatively light impact of the coronavirus on the Cape compared to the economic effects of the pandemic. The other one that was interesting was the gender gap was the largest that they had ever recorded, over 20 points. Women favored Biden 61% to 32%, while men favored Trump 40, 53% to 39%. Similarly, when asked if the government should play a large or small role in solving societal problems, women were more likely to say a large role, 51% to 38% for men. Did you find what was interesting to you in there?
Well, one thing they call out is about independent voters, and they were saying that usually in the past these have been the swing voters, but this time around they found independent voters splitting evenly, and again between Biden and Trump, and it just sort of reflects this bigger divide right here on the Cape and Islands. A lot of great work done by students at Monomoy Regional High School here. And you think about the challenges of doing this when they couldn't just go to the polls or can't, you know, do an exit poll the way you would typically do it. Here they were trying to figure out how to do it in a pandemic, just like everyone else who's trying to figure out how to cover an election in a pandemic.
I'm always amazed at the exit polling that these kids do because they are usually spot on. It's really impressive. And then that was the eighth graders. The high school age kids held a mock election on Monday, and also held a debate with the ninth congressional candidates, which they often do. And you know, they don't ask easy questions. They really do their homework and think about really solid questions to ask the candidates. So very impressive. John Dixon should be very proud of his students. I know he is. Mm-hmm. He's a fabulous teacher, and we need more John Dixons in the world, I think.
And we had them on the air with you last night, and it's great to hear the voices of the students themselves who are doing the work here. And really, it's kind of the most basic civics lesson you can have is to try to understand elections and how they work and the process of asking people about their how they vote and why. Yes.
Yeah. All right. So, Steve, covering this election was very different for us.
A little bit different, right?
Yeah.
You know, I was thinking even last night, Mindy, we typically have voters out at campaign events across the region on election night. And usually we've got two reporters for every race, so one at each campaign event. And we're calling out to them through the night and getting updates. And none of that last night, really.
Yeah, you were pretty much by yourself in the studio.
Yeah,
I was at home in my office here, and we had Jeff Spillane, the former political reporter at the Cape Cod Times, who was at his house, kind of covering the election last night that way, which was very different, and we didn't have all the hustle. But
I feel like so much of the ritual around politics and election day is so built into it, and as reporters, I was talking to a reporter who said, what am I going to do without pizza on election night? Because that's typically what happens in a reporting room. They send out and get pizza, and she was just going to order pizza in so that it still felt like election night there. But even on individual level, like yesterday, it was the first election day that I didn't go to the polls to vote because I sent my ballot in by mail, and it felt strange. There was a couple times through the day I was thinking, like, wait, when am I going to get down to my precinct to vote? And then remind myself, I didn't have to do it this year. So it must have felt different. I think it must have felt different for lots of people across the region to have a different kind of election that way. Definitely.
Yeah. And so one of the other things too is trying to figure out how you talk to children about the election, right? As many of you know, I actually have a 5-year-old who actually knows who the presidential candidates are, and they have their favorites as well. And it was interesting a couple of weeks ago when President Trump was in the hospital with COVID-19. My grandson said, "Is it true the president is in the hospital?" I said, "It is true." He said, "Who's telling people what to do?" So it was a great opportunity to talk about the role of vice president and, that there is a system in place. So how are you talking to your kids about it?
I have an 11-year-old who's completely consumed with the election. Like I came down. When he came down this morning, he wanted to know how Wisconsin voted. He said, and he said, "Are the results in for Pennsylvania yet?" And so it's really an opportunity to talk about how sometimes, I remember the Bush-Gore election, and it seemed like such a shock that we didn't have a winner the next morning. But it reinforced that this is the process, and the process of democracy sometimes is a bit messy and takes longer than we want it to. But this is it, and I think that this is a good opportunity to talk to kids about why we do things this way and what our expectations really should be. And it's a great opportunity to talk, I think, about so many of the issues around what it means to participate in a democracy and to vote, and what happens if the person you voted for doesn't win. And it's, you know, this is, you know, Nell Fields there was talking about trying to remember that this is kind of a small moment in our lives also, as well as being a big important thing, obviously. So you're trying to keep these two contexts together, that this is such a big event. And also, you know, for my 11-year-old kid, this is going to be something that happened when he was 11, and he's going to keep growing, and this election will be part of his childhood. And so it's interesting for all of us to try to balance these big and small ideas at the same time. Yes.
Yeah. I had an uncle who used to say, in 100 years, this is a drop in the bucket.
Right. And yet, you know, I think for
it's
a lot of people.
It's big in the moment, yeah.
But
yeah.
Also a lot of, you know, a lot of people care so passionately, obviously, about the issues at stake here. Things like the environment and the economy and even response to the pandemic. And people have such strong feelings, and rightly so. And so much is, they feel so much is at stake here. You know, there's social justice issues that people, we went out, we had reporters across the region yesterday and on Monday too, and also on Friday, talking to voters and potential voters about how they were going to vote and why. And it just, to me, is so inspiring to hear the voices of voters from the South Coast to the Outer Cape to the islands talking about their choices. And, you know, one of the questions we were asking people is, what issues matter so much to you that you're voting on them this time around, that they're influencing how you vote? And to hear people speak about their, not only the things that they're, you know, proactively concerned about, if you're concerned about the environment, but also their fears, their economic fears. And to hear people in their own voices talking about it, I think it reminds us that that's also really what this is about. It's not, there's the candidates up there, but really this is our democracy, and this is you and I and all our neighbors voting for how we make our way forward as best we can in all of this. And this pandemic is such a different layer of things for all of this.
Yeah. And I was also surprised, you know, in looking at our local races, there wasn't any real landslides. I mean, some of these races, you know, were closer than I imagined they would be.
I think that's, you know, you look at the Exaros race, the fifth Barnstable, and that was a hard-fought race and very close. And in the end, you know, with, as you said earlier, you know, two strong candidates. And, of course, the Cape region has this sort of the story of the delegation working across the party lines. Really, once the people are elected from the Cape region, they head up to the State House. They just traditionally work together and pull together, because so many of the issues that are so important to the Cape region really aren't party line specific.
Right, right, exactly. And that's the way you get things done. Right?
Yes,
to work by,
when you go up to the State House, you're representing this area. You're not representing, you know, one party or another, as Randy Hunt was saying also earlier, that, you know, you go up there and you are representing your constituents at the State House level. And again, there's wastewater and there's the opioid epidemic and so many things, education funding that are not specific to a party. They're specific to your constituents that you're fighting for.
Right. Constituent services, very, very big deal, that's for sure. And Steve Junker is the news director at CAI. Steve, thanks for coming in this morning. I know it was a late night for
and
for
you,
both
you were
of
here.
Us.
We were up past midnight watching all
past
this
midnight
good stuff.
For sure. Yeah. All right, thanks, Steve. I'm Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.